in the book Stuffed and Starved, there's a graph that kind of where I try and explain how this works. Imagine a sort of hourglass, if you will. You know, wide at the top, narrow in the middle, wide at the bottom. Now, at the top, imagine the millions of farmers around the world who are growing our food. And at the bottom, imagine the six, nearly 7 billion of us who are eating food every day. And then imagine the hourglass, the waste of the hourglass, the tiny bit in the middle, where the corporations that regulate and that are involved in the truck and barter of products are sat. Now, if you pick any agricultural commodity, any agricultural product at all, it'll be controlled, more than half of that market will be controlled by five corporations, more or less. But what we should be a little taken aback by is not that corporations are miscreants, but that there are markets in food at all. Why are there markets in food? Why is there a global market in anything? I mean, global markets in food are very weird. The world's first global market in food was the global market in wheat. And that was only completed in the 1880s. So global markets in food are less than 130 years old. And yet, of course, now we accept them as perfectly normal. And I think it's important to go back in time and see why global markets in food were constructed. And a good place to look at this is India. Now, India, before the British came, was a feudal society. A feudal society is one where there are landlords who own the land and then peasants who work on that land. And they work and they grow stuff, and the landlord takes it away and gives them back only enough for them to survive and to feed their kids. You know, not enough to thrive, not enough to be able to make money, nothing like that. The only upside to feudalism, and it's not, you know, not a terribly high upside, is that in years of famine, it is the landlord's responsibility to feed the peasants. But when the British came, they looked at this sort of moral economy and said, well, no, this is pathetically backward. What you need to do, Indians, is you need to introduce the market. You need to start introducing wage labor. You need to start introducing markets in land. And you need to start selling your wheat. And if you do that, you'll find that your productivity will go through the roof and things will be much better. The Indian landlord said, no, actually, we're good, thanks. And the British said, no, we've got guns. They imposed occasionally by force, and often by force, these markets in grain. But to some extent, the British did not lie, because agricultural productivity went through the roof. India became a major exporter of grain, and Indian grain productivity went up. But when you introduce markets in food, you introduce two very simple rules. The first rule is this, that if you have money, you can get food from wherever around the world you want. And so what was happening was that Britain, which happened to have quite a lot of money, was paying for grain to be shipped from India to Britain to feed its workers. That's the market at work. But of course, the other rule that the market imposes is this, that if you do not have money, you do not get to eat. And so there are stories of agricultural workers, of workers piling the grain onto ships that were destined for Liverpool and then dying on the docks because they couldn't afford the food that they were loading. And this is an important point, that actually hunger in India went up through the imposition of the market. Not because there was a shortage of food. There was more food than ever before. But the reason people starved was because of poverty and because the only way that they could access food was through the market. Now, that situation in India is one that is also being imposed on other countries. Other countries are being forced into this agricultural liberalization, bringing in of the free market, the reduction of support for farmers, for poor people. The agency that is doing that is an organization for which I worked for a month, an organization called the World Bank. The World Bank has this sort of moment of, hey, man, go buy yourself something nice. You have millions of dollars in loans. Go on, it'll be splendid. But of course, it's a loan, so it's taken back. And the punch in the face is precisely these things called conditionalities, where the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund are in a position where they get to dictate the economic policy and therefore the social policy of the countries that they lend to. If you want to see the consequences of that close to home, All you have to do is look to the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Look to Haiti. Haiti, in the 1980s, grew the majority of its own rice. Haiti was able to grow its own rice, and it was good at it. But because of these structural adjustment loans, these loans that the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank impose, and which were in turn part of conditions that Reagan and then Clinton imposed on Haiti. So I just want to be clear that there's no Republican, Democrat, good side, bad side here. Both sides were responsible for pushing these loans on Haiti, as well as pretty much every other developing country. But Haiti underwent a structural adjustment program, and it meant that Haitian farmers had to compete on the field of free trade with every other rice farmer in the world, including US rice farmers. The trouble is, of course, there is no level playing field in agriculture. US rice farmers get $1 billion a year in subsidy. And it's not just the US that's bad about this. European Union cows get more than Haitians earn every day. So it's not particularly a US thing. It's certainly bad on the other side of the Atlantic as well. But the consequence for Haiti had a lot to do with US policy. Because in a world where you're earning $2 a day and they're getting $1 billion a year, it's not surprising that the Haitian rice industry was nuked. There was nothing left of it. And recently, with the food price spikes, there have been food riots in Haiti. And the food that people are fighting over is food that has a big American flag on it and the words, "Gift of the People of the United States." Although I go to Europe and give a talk like this, the one thing that's guaranteed to bring in a sharp intake of breath is this fact, that 20% of American fast food meals are eaten in cars. 20% of American fast food meals are eaten in cars. And people in Europe, when they hear that, they ask, "But why?" and they wonder, is it because Americans love their cars? Is it some sort of fascination with the dashboard or the end of the mirror? But of course, we understand that Americans, I mean, particularly working class Americans, are working much harder than everyone else in the industrialized world for things that everyone else in the industrialized world takes for granted. Things like healthcare, things like a pension, things like affordable housing, affordable education. And if you're holding down two jobs to be able to keep payments on the insurance and payments on the house, and you're running from one place to another, you've got to take care of the kids, it's no wonder that the choices you have to make are the choices between Burger King or McDonald's. Between the choices of the things you get to eat off your lap. I'm heartened by the ideas of slow food, and also by an international group of peasants called Via Campesina. And they have a vision, and I guess I'm going to end with this, that they have a vision of how our food future could be. And it's a vision they called food sovereignty. And the idea, basically, is that we should take democratic control of our food system. We should be making decisions about how we get to eat, how food is distributed, what it is that is grown, how it is that things are grown, and that those decisions be made not by a few corporations. The story that I've just given you about the global food system is one in which corporations and a couple of governments made the decisions for the entire planet. Well, they're saying, no, we in Via Campesina want to have a vision of food being shared by all, and the politics of food being shared by everyone. And this movement is 150 million people strong. 150 million people in everywhere from the United States, where the National Family Farm Coalition is a representative, to India, where the Karnataka State Farmers Association is in 20 million people there, to Brazil. It is a planetary movement. But there are people out there fighting the good fight for democracy, particularly when it comes to food. And I think we need to realize that, yes, we need to sort of support our local farmers market, get out of supermarkets, but we also need to engage in politics. And I think that actually, if we're going to reclaim our food system, we will need better politics, and we will need to realize that we need to become more involved in democracy. And at the end of the day, that means realizing, and this is my last thought, I think that we need to realize that we are not consumers of democracy. We are its proprietors.